Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. A couple of weeks ago, we got together with our listeners and asked for suggestions about what you'd like to hear. And today's show is a product of one of those suggestions. The question was asked, what about these place names we have in Anchorage? Russian Jack, who is that? Who is Lynn Airy of Lynn Airy Park? Who is Joe Spinard, after whom a big part of our town is named? And I started looking into that and thinking that was a really interesting topic. And so I've asked a couple of historians to come into the studio. And in the process, we realized there's much more to talk about here, because place names and interesting characters from the past are only part of the story. There's a much bigger story in how we come up with these myths we have about ourselves, how we create our self-image as a community. So we're going to be talking about that too. Stay with us, and we're really hoping that you will call with your own stories of the people who made Anchorage, the people who made Alaska, and your questions. Wouldn't be fair to call it beat the band or stump the band, because I'm sure you could stump us very easily. But I do have two very illustrious guests with me. Steve Haycox is professor emeritus, University of Alaska Anchorage, and author of Alaska American Colony. Thanks for being with us, Steve.
My pleasure.
And Katie Ringsmith, or Katherine Johnson Ringsmith is her pen name, is the author of Alaska's Flyboys, Cowboy Pilots and the Myth of the Last Frontier, a new book which has just come out. I've been fortunate enough to take a look at it. I think it's going to be very popular. Anchorage is gaga about aviation history, and Katie has really delved into it and done it right in a serious way, and also a book with a great photo section. And that book is on the shelves now, Katie?
Yes, it came out on October 1st. Thanks, Charles.
We're right on top of it. Yep. University of Washington Press.
Yes, University of Washington Press.
All right. Well, I want to start with a couple of names. And I thought, Katie, you'll take the seat of honor because you were most recently published. And I thought we'd start with a name which is, and I'm going to give out the listeners, I'm going to give out the phone number for you to get on board in just a minute after you get what the show is about. Mudhole Smith. Now, here's a guy who, after whom the Cordova Airport is named, because he's an aviator. The Alaska Department of Transportation refused to put the name Mudhole Smith on the airport until the community rebelled and insisted they do it, and really was one of the founders of Alaska Airlines. So how did Mudhole Smith get his name?
Oh, Mudhole. Yeah, he didn't even like that name very much.
Who would?
Yeah, right. I mean, it was Smitty, right? That was, yeah, aviators love nicknames. Merle Smith was a brand new pilot from the Midwest. He came up and got a job with Cordova Air, flying out of Cordova and servicing the mines in the Wrangells. And so the Wrangells
frame.
And the Chukotka. So this had been about 1930s, 1937,
wow.
Particularly.
Yeah.
And so this is before regulation, and there was a lot of competition for, you know, the Nabesna mine and particularly the Bremner mine. Bremner, actually, they started Cordova Air. That's how intimate they were. The owners of the mine started Cordova Air. And so Bob Reeve felt a little bit of ownership as
Bob Reeve,
serving
another legendary
this. Right,
aviator.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So here comes this kid flying in, and Bremner had a new airfield that they had just built, and it was way up on the top near the mine. It was really wet and marshy there, and he flew in August, and they filled it in, the marsh, and then they put these rocks on there to serve as kind of the hard spot for the airstrip.
Uh-huh.
And the flyers knew that before they took off, they had to go and inspect the strip to ensure that there weren't any loose rocks. And, you know, Mudhole didn't do it, hence he was flying in the famous C-2B biplane. He hit a hole, a mud hole to be precise.
Somebody moved a rock or a rocket.
Yeah, it just, yeah, landing or whatever, and it flips. And Peyton, one of the Bremner mine owners, wrote in his journal, you know, this happened to Merle Smith, and now we're going to, you know, we call him Mudhole, that old Mudhole. And then he told Reeve that story. And when Merle Smith came face to face with Reeve, he said, you know, gave this poor kid a hard time. But what it does is the story, you know, it's lighthearted and kind of fun and gave this guy this nickname for life. But it also underscores the rivalry that existed,
yeah,
between these flyers, especially in places like the Wrangell Mountains,
right,
there in East
Alaska.
Well,
I love the fact that the Cordova Airport is named
cool.
Mudhole.
Yeah.
Yeah, because a rock was out of place. You know,
right,
these guys were flying in places that that almost seem crazy that they would fly.
And so, it also shows just how important aviation was to the community and to the people.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, Steve, let me throw one to you. Who is Joe Spinard?
Oh, Joe Spinard was not all that important a guy, really. He was a Canadian. Of course, a lot of good Alaskans are Canadians in the beginning. But he came into the territory around 1910, eventually found his way to Anchorage to the railroad site. He worked for the railroad. He started a trucking service, City Express. And so he would deliver stuff and was kind of flashy about that. But his real claim to fame is that it was difficult to get across the Chester Creek mudflats. Some folks who've been around for a little while may remember that it wasn't always that nice lagoon we have down there. It was a very, very wide mudflat area, and it was difficult to get across, even as far east as C Street. And what he did was he cut down logs and made a corduroy road across it and kind of maintained that because he had a homestead up there. And particularly as he poked around up there, now that was wilderness back in the 20s, the early 20s.
Way out of town, yeah.
He found a lake that folks hadn't really focused on. And that, of course, would become Lake Spinard. And he built, eventually, a, shall we say, recreational spot.
Right.
The best part of the recreation was the booze in it. Uh-huh. Now, remember, Alaska had a bone dry law, and it was prohibition in the 1930s. And so it was a nice spot to get out of town. Now, the interesting part about all of that is it was on National Forest Service land.
Right.
It was part of the Chugach National Forest. And so there were some interesting fisticuffs involved in that, most of which Joe Spinard won, mostly because the Forest Service just didn't have the energy or the personnel to go after it.
And people were swimming out there, even in those early
days. People went out and they swam. He had a dock out there, and folks swam in the lake.
And that nightclub was where you went if you wanted to meet somebody and you didn't want people to know you were meeting them.
Which I have a hard time imagining.
With the small number
of people in town. Who's missing tonight?
Yeah,
I wonder where they are.
So then we get this whole area of town named Spinard.
Then the whole area of town becomes Spinard, and it resisted being annexed into the city, being part of the city for a while, mostly, I think, because of zoning regulation and taxing and the things that go along with that, kind of a normal annexation thing. But there was a little bit of cachet that went along with it, too. Oh, not quite the seamy underside, but we're kind of the rebellious outsiders where Anchorage is concerned. But now Anchorage has enveloped the place entirely.
Completely, yeah. But now it's sort of the hipster neighborhood, which I think is really funny.
That's fun.
There was a very politically incorrect, in fact, somewhat offensive phrase, but also kind of funny, the Spinard divorce at one time, which I don't think anybody says anymore, which meant you shot your spouse.
That's right. That's right. Exactly.
And that was, it happened commonly enough that there's a word for it.
Well, and as you well know, Charles, during and after the war, when there were so many military personnel here and the ratio of men to women was quite unbalanced, there was a lot of drinking. There was a lot of violence. If you go through the police rosters for a given day, most of it's arrests for intoxication and domestic violence and that sort of thing. A lot of fistfights on the streets, but I guess we're not quite beyond that yet.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that took place in Spinard. You look at the rosters for any given week, and there's lots of burglaries, and it's people breaking into folks' houses in Spinard to get enough money to go out to Joe Spinard's place and drink.
Boozing. Yeah, was a rough and tumble.
It was rough
place,
and tumble.
Yeah. All right. There you have it, folks. That's what we're doing today. We're telling these old stories about Anchorage and about aviation history. And we're also going to do some of the proper historical stuff about taking some of these stories apart and figuring out what they mean on Hometown Alaska today. And we would certainly love to get you on board. Maybe you know some stories. I know there's some folks in Anchorage who do because we're a young town. Or maybe you have questions. Maybe you want to know about some aspect of Anchorage history. The phone number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. That's 888-357-5752, toll-free from outside Anchorage. And email is a great way to get on the air, too, hometown@alaskapublic.org. And I'll give those numbers again in a little while, but remember, you can always find them on our website if you're on your smartphone. Just look up alaskapublic.org, today's show, Real Characters of Anchorage History. Phone numbers are right there. You can probably just tap the link on your phone and you'll be with us. So I want to share something. I recently wrote a book called From the Shores of Ship Creek, which is Centennial History of Anchorage. And I did some interviews that were really, really fun and enlightening. And Steve Haycox had previously done interviews with some pioneers who were gone. I used those quite a bit. And one person I talked to, I would say the interview that I enjoyed the most was with Brooke Marston, who is one of the founders of the Turnagain neighborhood and obviously is still around. Wilda Marston, his wife, was a huge pillar and builder of our community. Brooke Marston's father was Muktuk Marston, who was the founder of the Alaska Territorial Guard, went around the state during World War II and formed Native villages into National Guard units to defend Alaska during World War II. Well, Brooke was a kid. They lived on 12th Avenue. They had an anti-aircraft gun in their front yard, and he was a teenager who was allowed to wander, and it just so happens that he wandered out the coast and met a old Russian soldier named Lynn Airy. And I'm sure a lot of people know about Lynn Airy Park. And so I've got a recording from that interview, just a short snippet of it, about Brooke, this teenager, meeting this Russian guy, which ended up being the founding of the Turnagain neighborhood. So let's go ahead and hear that.
When I came here, I, of course, wandered loose up and down, and I got acquainted with Lynn Airy, who was building a log cabin here.
Huh. So your family had moved to Anchorage because of the war, and you were just a young man, mm-hmm. or a teenager, wandering
right.
around.
Mm-hmm.
And so Lynn Airy, that was a man?
Yeah. Actually, it's Lirin Airy, but they shorten it to Lynn Airy. He was Russian, and he was a supply sergeant in the Russian army.
Huh.
And this, you were required to be responsible for anything that you took that was issued. And then you issued it to somebody else, then he was responsible.
Uh-huh.
And he took possession of 2,000 boots and signed his name for it. And he got to looking at it, and the soles fell off of them. And he had visions of being in jail for the rest of his life.
Uh-huh.
So he fled to Germany, and from Germany to Minnesota, and from Minnesota he came up here. And he built a log cabin, or was in the process of it, when I met him out here.
Huh, just right out where the park is.
Right out there, right where the park is.
So you're just a boy sort of wandering along the shoreline and you meet this old Russian mm-hmm. guy building a cabin.
And eventually, because I got involved with him, my father came out here and said, gee, this is great. Should be a subdivision out here. But
so did you go back and make friends with him, just hang out
Oh,
there?
Yeah. Yeah, we knew Airy very, very well.
But I mean, when before you introduced your father to him?
Yeah, oh yeah. Uh-huh. No, he actually cut the timber right here and hand-edged it and hand-fitted it. And the cabin still exists.
Where is it?
It's on 32nd Street, about in the middle, between Wisconsin and Turnagain Street.
So if you go down 32nd, it's pretty easy to see that cabin because you can see how he did these beautiful dovetail joints at the corners, which is why that cabin didn't fall down in the 64 earthquake, even though it fell over at a 45-degree angle because it was so well put together. And that was Brooke and Wilda's house, and the Corps of Engineers dragged it over to 32nd Street, where it still stands. And then, of course, Muktuk Marston got together with Wally Hickel. They built the Turnagain neighborhood, and there you are.
There you go.
And I think it's so fun that, you know, just go out and talk to an old-timer, and you get the whole story.
You get the story.
What a unique town we live in. So it's Hometown Alaska on KSKA, and my guests are Steve Haycox and Katie Ringsmuth. Katie's book, Alaska Flyboys, Cowboy Pilots, and the Myth of the Last Frontier, has just come out from University of Washington Press, and we're talking about the real characters of our history. Right now, I'd like to go to a call from Jim in Anchorage. Jim?
Hi.
Yeah, hi. Yeah. Go ahead with your comment.
Okay, well, my wife and I wrote a history of Holy Family Church, and one of the stories I really liked was about Otto Olson, who ran the railroad, and the priest in town, Father O'Flanagan, had made arrangements through the Sisters of Providence to build a hospital in town, and the material was shipped directly to Anchorage. And Otto didn't like that. He wanted stuff shipped to Seward so he could charge on the railroad to have it brought up here. And that's how he was the first person to turn a profit, I think, at the Alaska Railroad. But he was a real character. So he was upset, and he parked a row of railroad cars in front of the access to the port so they couldn't download the stuff that was on the ship. And I think it took a call to the city government before he would move it and let them shift this stuff out. But, you know, he struck me as a real kind of Alaska character that, you know, you don't hear much about, but was kind of operating a little at the edge.
I think you're right. I think he was to credit for the railroad staying alive through the 1930s because he was such a hard driver. On the other hand, I think it was actually World War II that saved the railroad.
It certainly was. There's a wonderful story about that. The truckers on the Richardson Highway really got upset because he kept trying to drive them out of business by undercutting the prices that they had to charge. And then on top of that, the Road Commission would charge them a toll for going over the bridges. And one of my favorite stories is the truckers getting together and tearing out the gates so that they could...
Right. I just read about this in that Wilson's book, where there was the ferry over the Tanana River, and they upped the fare to go across to some crazy amount so that the railroad would be competitive. And so the truckers refused to pay. They took the guy who drove the ferry. They tied him up, left him in a chair, and then they were all arrested. And the Fairbanks jury refused to convict.
Absolutely,
the perfect ending to the story.
Perfect story.
Well, thanks, Jim. That was a great story. That was a good addition. Otto Olson.
Can I just put in a quick thank you to you personally? When we started writing the book, I came up to you at one of the early centennial celebration meetings, and I said, I don't know how to do this. And you told me, I believe I have this right, you said, just sit down and start writing and just keep going every day. And, you know, I owe you. So thank you for that. And your show is great, and I'm enjoying it.
Oh, thank you. I don't know if that was good advice or not, but I guess it worked.
Reminds one of the story that's told about Pete Seeger, Melvina Reynolds, who wrote Boxes, Little Boxes, Little Boxes, uh-huh. Just the Same, was trying to write folk songs, and Seeger did a concert in San Francisco, and she went and said, "How do I do this?" And she said, "Sit down and write." Yeah. He said, "Sit down and write.
Yeah, but
keep writing."
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Jim. Thanks for the compliment. I appreciate it very much. So. I wanted to hand another one over to you, Katie, about Bob Reeve. His family is very famous in Anchorage. Reeve Boulevard, of course, is named after him. What's Bob Reeve's story? Where does he come from?
Well, Bob Reeve drifted into Valdez in the early 1930s, penniless, as the story goes. He came from South America, where he was flying for Pan Am down there in some, you know, enormous spans in distance, down in the Andes Mountains. And he came up here, and he wanted to get in basically with the gold boom. And lucky for Bob Reeve, he came in just at the time during the Great Depression, when Franklin Roosevelt shepherded in legislation through Congress that almost doubled the price of gold, which gave the miners now the ability to hire aviators to help them access places that were way up high in the mountains. And what brought Bob Reeve, his kind of claim to fame, was that he was a filthy flyer. And he figured out a way to...
What does that mean?
Well, he... you're mining in the summertime up in the glaciers, hence his nickname, the glacier pilot, right? And so he had to figure out how to land on skis up in the high altitudes, but he's flying from Valdez where there's no snow. So he figured out how to take off from the mud flats and land on the high areas to supply the miners on skis. So and Harold Gillam, who was a very, very clean guy, just said, you know, basically Reeve could have that. He would rather carry around people than stuff. But he was filthy in other ways, too. He, like, for example, there was such competition among these flyers. And so if the Valdez miner ran a paper or a story, for example, about how Harold Gillam, made a kind of a sketchy landing, he'd put his advertisement, "Always fly Reeve," right below the article just to kind of remind flyers, if you're a little worried about flying with Gillam, you could fly with me. But he was quite a guy, and I think really personifies this notion of a a sky boy. He was the perfect quality. He had that quality about him.
Well, your book is titled Alaska's Flyboys, Cowboy Pilots, and the Myth of the Last Frontier. Skyboys, not flyboys. And I'm wondering, you know, you use this word myth, and it sounds like they were doing some of their own myth making, being in the paper and sort of being constantly talked about. What is the myth? The story that we think of about these early aviators is mythic rather than being sort of, maybe you might think, factual.
Right. I mean, I think what's factual is they were daring, they were courageous, they needed a necessary skill set. I guess my question was, when I approached this, is even though they're flying around on 20th century technology that really is going to cement the United States as, you know, the American century. I mean, aviation is what puts us on the map. Why is it that in Alaska, we talk about bush pilots like cowboys? We use the same language. We use the same prose to talk about that. And so I tried to look to history to answer that, not taking anything away from the pilots, because I think what they do is extraordinary. Personally, I'm terrified to fly. I don't know how to fly. And
funny that you chose this topic.
But my job requires me, and I depend on pilots to keep me safe in the air. And I believe what they do is extraordinary.
But why do you think it was important for them to create those myths?
Well, because I think, number one, the narrative itself is limiting. It leaves a lot out of the story. And I think the big one was the role of government. Like, you know, no one ever talks about the reason why Reeve was the glacier pilot, because FDR, you know, doubled the price in gold and made his job all of a sudden feasible. No one really talks about the Alaska Road Commission, who built the aviation field. It wasn't just sheer, you know, mavericky. And it was the regulations that stabilize the industry. Otherwise, those guys were flying around like crazy people and just trying to make a living. And there's this incredible story where Bob Reeve flies Washburn out to Mount Lacania so he could climb up to the highest unnamed peak. Or unclimbed peak. So he was going to fly out there, and they get stuck out there. It's June, and it's warm, and Reeve can't take off in his Fairchild. And there's the three different accounts I looked at is the account by Beth Day, and she gets the story straight from Reeve. And then there's Washburn's account, and then his fellow climber, Bob Bates. And everybody tells basically the same story, which is extraordinary. After 5 days, Reeve has had enough of this, and he just gets in his Fairchild, and he's just popping around, and he just disappears over the cliff. And Washburn and Bates are waiting to hear the crash. I mean, there's like, where do you go? And then all of a sudden, whoosh, there's the plane, and you can just hear the orchestra in the background as the Fairchild takes off out. And the way Bob tells it is he was getting airspeed. Going
falling.
Down, right, so he could go up.
Wow.
But what he doesn't tell, but what Bob Bates tells is he was absolutely panicked to get out of there because Tilly, his wife, had a brand new baby at home.
Yeah.
So the reason why he's flying this way isn't because he's trying to be daring. It's because he's trying to feed his family, take care of his family. And I think that's really the stories that get left out because of this narrow focus of how we talk about them.
And Tilly Reeve, who lived a long life and lived right in Fairview, I think like on 12th Avenue, a very well-loved person.
Right. Well, that was
so, Steve, I just want to bring this over to you because I know you've written about a lot about this topic of Alaska history myth. And I was speaking to some high school kids this week about the fact that, okay, we had the Alaska Railroad. 100% of the economy of Anchorage was based on this government-funded railroad through the 1930s. Then our economy was based on World War II military spending. And then in the 50s, 75% of the Alaska economy was based on Cold War spending. Then we had the earthquake, and we had all this federal spending again. And so I said, you know, okay, this is a government town. We were created by government. I asked them to raise their hands. How many of you have families with a government paycheck? And it was like more than a third.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't think of ourselves as being a government town or paid for by government. On the contrary.
Quite so. It's fascinating. We're all the hero of our own dreams. The individual heroic story, of course, is much more appealing than sort of some sort of institutional history and economic analysis. And I think Katie nails it really well. It's not so much that these guys, Bob Reeve and Mudhole Smith, created the mythology, perhaps to some degree. I mean, they were always self-promoters. They needed to be in order to survive. But I think that we also create the myth with them at the center of the myth, the heroic individual bush pilot. The whole thing about the sourdough is that the sourdough is beholden to nobody. The sourdough makes it on his own. And he's not supported by anybody else. Well, that's not really true. That's not quite how you do it, starting with the compendium of mining law that you have in your back pocket and whoever grubstakes you and the government keeping the steamships running on the river and all of that. But that's boring, and there's nothing ostensibly exciting about it. But the individual out there pulling themselves up by their own bootstraps, that's an image I've really always had trouble with. Not quite sure how to do.
Yeah.
I've always wondered about the there's always a piece ripped out of the brim of the sourdough hat, too. I don't know, what is that, a bear, or where did that go? There's those images I find. But I think that's the secret. I mean, we want the larger story because we want to be associated with the larger story. I'm an Alaskan. You go to the lower 48 and you say, I'm an Alaskan. Ooh, wow, that's exciting. What's it like?
We're still, the reality TV industry is still building that myth, aren't they?
Even today, I mean...
And when we look at that, we know it's absurd. I mean, it's funny to watch, but that's sort of part of what Alaska is to people.
Well, and here's a basic piece of data that I think helps put it all into perspective. 70% of Alaska is urban. 70% of the people who live in Alaska live in urban areas. And now if you take out like maybe, 50 or 60,000 natives who live in isolated villages, the rest living in much of the time in town, I mean, most people in Alaska live very highly civilized, if you will, lives with immediate access to the material norm of American culture. And yet we want to identify ourselves as frontier people.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the media plays a big role in that, too.
Yeah.
I found that the writers of the day had a very difficult time explaining aviation to the general public. No one understands. It's like, okay, describe your magic trick right now and make it interesting for your readers or your listeners. It's impossible to really understand, you know, how do you make this thing fly up in the air? So they really did concentrate on the charismatic pilots, and they did tell stories. And in the 1930s, people needed heroes.
It's kind of like we are today with our Silicon Valley heroes and our computers that we don't understand. Yeah. Great topic. So we're gonna go to a break and come back and talk more about some of the real characters of Anchorage history and Alaska aviation history as well, and also the realities. And I would love to hear questions, observations from listeners, or maybe memories you have, or maybe there's some place names you're wondering about. We might be able to answer, we might not, or maybe another listener could. So I'll give those phone numbers out in just a minute when we come back. Stay with us as Hometown Alaska continues.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Back on Hometown Alaska. We're talking today about the real characters of Anchorage history, and we'd love to hear your questions or comments, memories you have, or place names you're curious about. The phone number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752, and if you want to reach us by email, I'll read your questions to our experts. Hometown@alaskapublic.org is the email address. And, you know, if you ever find that you want to call in and you can't find those numbers, just go to alaskapublic.org. They're very easy to find. Two guests in the studio today, Katie Ringsmuth, who's the author of the new book, Alaska Sky Boys, Cowboy Pilots, and the Myth of the Last Frontier, just out this week from University of Washington Press and available. And Steve Haycox, professor emeritus, University of Alaska Anchorage, and author of Alaska American Colony. And so our topic today is these interesting characters and also what the way we talk about our history reflects about us. And so I had the privilege of writing the centennial history of Anchorage for our just past centennial. Someone I learned about that I found really fascinating was Andrew Cunningham. You may have noticed a little street called Cunningham Avenue downtown leads over the bluff to from the railroad station up to 3rd Avenue. It's there because when Andrew Cunningham laid out our streets, he laid them out in a grid, and the street leading straight down into Ship Creek was too steep, so they needed a more gradual street. They put in that one diagonal street and named it for him, and he's the person who's famous in that picture of the town site auction where he's auctioning off the properties. And a fascinating person, was essentially the czar of Anchorage in its early years when it was a federal project and didn't have any local government. A very benevolent czar, very proud of what he was doing. Wrote about him and said in the book, you know, we don't know too much about him as personally. But then it turns out that his grandson is still alive and is living in Cincinnati. And his wife was doing some genealogical research, stumbled upon our centennial website, stumbled upon what had been written about Andrew Cunningham, and said, well, I remember lots about my grandpa. And so he called me up, and I interviewed him just last week, and he sent me a big packet of information about the later life of Andrew Cunningham, which was really pretty much completely unknown. And it's somewhat interesting, but
slight correction before you go further. Christensen.
I'm sorry. I said Cunningham the entire time. I do that. You know, I'll just have mental slip. Yeah. So Christensen went on to be essentially a banker for a trust company. One of my favorite stories was how he took his grandson to see Jackie Robinson play at Ebbets Field. That's the right
Ebbets
name.
Field,
yeah.
Right.
And told him about how important this is. We're seeing the first black man play in Major League Baseball.
Terrific.
So interesting character, lived all the way till 1969.
Wonderful.
So let's take some phone calls. We've got some folks who are calling in with our topic today. Stephen is calling from Palmer.
Hi, this is Stephen out here in Palmer.
Uh-huh.
I had a friend, an older guy, back in about 1975 or 76. I was working in Valdez as a young apprentice carpenter. And the older guy, his name was Troy Morrow. And he was probably 70 years old at the time. I said, what are you doing working here with your tools at this age? He said, well, I missed a good bet. And he told me that he was buddies with Muktuk Marston. And Muktuk one day told him, hey, Troy, what are you going to do with your life? You don't own a house. You don't own any place. I'm going to give you 40 acres out in Spinard. And Troy said, what the heck am I going to do with 40 acres all the way out of town in Spinard? And so he turned that down. He turned down Muktuk Marston's gift of 40 acres out in Spinard. I think that was probably in the mid 40s sometime. So
yeah,
that,
I love those stories. Yeah, when I was a kid, you heard those stories. I could have homesteaded, you know, where Sears is. I could have homesteaded, you know, at 36th Avenue. And actually, Dan Cuddy, who died just recently, told me that his bank is where he used to shoot muskrats when he was a kid. So
yeah,
rapid expansion. Yep, that sounds like a true Alaskan story to me.
Okay, well, you guys have a nice day.
Thanks for calling, Stefan. That was a good one. Now let's go to Alex, who's calling from Anchorage. Alex?
Hey, how you doing?
Great.
I just wanted to touch on a little bit of the aviation and a book that I read. I forgot what your female guest's name is.
Katie Ringsmuth.
Okay. Well, anyways, I read a book called For the Love of Mountains is Best, and it's by a gentleman of the name of Robert Bates, who was Bradford Washburn's climbing partner. She had just mentioned him with Bob Reeves and how Bob Reeves had gotten started and touched on one of the stories about that. But anyways, it's a great book to read. They did a lot of the Army testing up on McKinley. He was in Fairbanks for a big earthquake when it shut down all the Richardson, and it happened down here, not the 64, but earlier than that. They were back in the 30s. So I just want to let your listeners know For the Love of Mountains is Best, our best, and it's by Robert Bates, who is Bradford Washburn's climbing partner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, can you comment on that book, Katie?
Yeah, that's the account that I read as well when I got a different perspective of Bob, and it really helped. You know, instead of just taking Bob's word for it, and as Steve pointed out, he was creating an image for himself because he had just started, you know, Reeve Airlines heading down to the Aleutians. And so, you know, that to get Bob's perspective, especially his concern for Tilly, and, you know, it's not like he could pull out the cell phone and call and say, honey, I'm going to be a little late. You know, she would have been, you know, beside herself. And so, and Bob Bates, and he does, he talks a lot about Washburn too and the work that they did to not just advance mountaineering in the area, but also the scientific efforts that were going on in the early 1950s during the Cold War. And in fact, all of the scientific effort on top of Mount Wrangell, which was supported through aviation, became the impetus for up in Fairbanks, the Geophysical Institute.
Okay,
yeah,
sure,
lost it
sure.
there for a second.
Yeah.
So that was also very important. Mm-hmm. And Washburn was very much a part of that as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And I believe that they were climbing for the National Geographic Society.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
When they're in the St. Elias Range there also, which they did a lot of work for in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Brad Washburn is a wonderful, interesting guy. He lived a very long life, and a lot of people knew him because he didn't die all that long ago.
And there's fantastic photographs of many of their expeditions just right here at UAA.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for calling, Alex. That was a good one. So I want to turn to Steve Haycox. One of the listener questions we got from the caller who suggested doing this show was asking about Russian Jack. What an odd name that is.
Interesting. I want to give credit to Bruce Parham, the former director of the National Archive branch here, which isn't here anymore, and Walter Van Horn, former curator at the Anchorage Museum. They've been following up on a project started by John Bogoy of Bogoy's mm-hmm. Florist. The family had sold the floral business a long time ago, but John grew up with it. And John put together a project of celebrating Alaska Anchorage pioneers. And you can go down to the museum and see that exhibit. And the reason I cite Bruce and Walter is because they've just been updating some of that. And I got some new information about Russian Jack from the work that Bruce and Walter have been doing. He's an interesting guy. He was born in the Ukraine, fled Russia, eventually found his way to Alaska, perhaps hit Anchorage in 1916, worked for the Alaska Engineering Commission, owned a pool hall at one time. Pool halls were notorious for their association with illegal gambling and drinking in the back, particularly after Prohibition. But he never became a citizen, wasn't naturalized, and so he couldn't really own it legally, apparently, at that time. I don't know that I know what the loss was, but apparently he couldn't own it. Anyway, he became a bootlegger and eventually set up a still out of town, way out of town, actually, way out where Russian Jack Springs Park is today.
Oh.
He did not have the homestead. It was owned by somebody. It was held by somebody else who actually never proved it up and therefore never got full title to it.
Oh.
So that piece of it was really...
So he's kind of squatting out there.
He was a squatter. He was absolutely a squatter. And he made his booze out there in the summertime, then he would truck it into town. In the wintertime, he moved into town because it was a little too far to try to negotiate the winter road out there. So he was well known. John Bagoy used to go around and collect bottles from Zach Lusak's drugstore.
Huh.
Zach marketed some of Russian Jack's illegal stuff out the back of his store. And John would go around downtown and pick up the bottles and take them to Russian Jack and get some money for it. One of the more interesting pieces of Russian Jack's story.
Russian Jack must have had a last name, but maybe we don't even know that.
He was born Jacob Maronenko.
Okay.
Jacob Maronenko in the Ukraine. But in America, somewhere along the line, maybe down in California, maybe up here in Alaska, it became Jack Marchin.
Oh, okay.
Jack Marchin. And so Jack Marchin, because he was Russian or Ukrainian, got to be known as Russian Jack the bootlegger.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was involved in a really interesting incident in 1938. He went to a party, and he was sweet on a gal named Doris Simmons. But there was a taxicab driver, Eddie, who was also sweet on Doris Simmons. And to make a long story short, they got into a fisticuff, and Eddie was choking Russian Jack, who reached in his pocket and fired his revolver, and it just happened to kill Eddie.
Gosh.
So he was brought up on charges, and the jury convicted him of manslaughter. It was self-defense. His defense was self-defense. But the jury recommended leniency, and so Simon Helenthal, another important Anchorage fellow or Alaska mm-hmm. fellow, Judge Simon Helenthal, sentenced him to 2.5 years at McNeil Island Federal Penitentiary down Steilacoom in Seattle area. He came back to Anchorage after that and continued to bootleg. Eventually moved to California or Arizona, and when he died, was put in an unmarked grave.
Oh.
One of the last things that John Bagoy did before he died was to go find the grave and put a grave marker on it.
Oh, God. It's so funny, you know, to think that, in a sense, all you got to do to get your name put on something is be the first one there, right?
That's about right.
So we named a big part of our town after a bootlegger who's squatting out in the woods.
Indeed, convicted murderer,
yeah.
If you will.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like, yeah, and there's so many other good stories like that. Hometown Alaska, I'm Charles Wolforth. My guests are Steve Haycox and Katie Ringsmuth, and we welcome your calls. If you have questions about Anchorage historical characters or aviation historical characters, you can call us at 550-8433, 550-8433. If you're outside Anchorage, 888-353-5752, and the email address is hometown@alaskapublic.org. I know you're both educators and teach Alaska history, and I wonder if there's some special challenges to that because of the fact that we do have this independence myth or some of these stories that we like to tell ourselves, which people cling to fairly closely. And Katie, I mean, when you're teaching, do you find that you have to break anybody's imaginary sort of figures in order to bring some reality to the question, or is that something that students are welcome?
Well, I do think that people do come in with preconceived ideas as to what they think Alaska is. And I think what's interesting is those ideas have changed and transformed over time. I mean, and usually one myth is created to supersede another myth, you know, which I think is really fascinating. I mean, when... when Alaska was first purchased, it was Seward's Folly. That was this idea, or the icebox, or that then it became an exotic place, the land of the Eskimo. And then, you know, during the Great Depression, I think that's when you see this need for heroes and attachment to, you know, the West, where you get The Last Frontier, this idea that, and then you add, I think you kind of keep moving along, and then you have the environmental movement, and then it becomes a place, a wild frontier, a place, you know, where there are, you know, where no man has touched these untouched places. And I think, you know, now we're the end of the road, the bridge to nowhere. Mm-hmm. And I think my goal in my classes is to say that our history, what it says is we are not really none of those things. What we are is a place that is constantly changing, moving. Even our geology itself has come from someplace else. You know, climate change is nothing new. The fact that Anchorage now, we're the city of 100 languages. Well, our history shows that that is not a new phenomena. And so I think by taking and looking at the big picture, looking at how all these different people and bringing their traditions and their ideas to Alaska has together created this idea of what Alaska is. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important, that Alaska isn't the bridge to nowhere. We are the bridge, and we connect to these two big, you know, geo-regions, the Pacific Rim and the Circumpolar North. And I think that when we became that, you know, everybody became outside with the capital mm-hmm. O, it was during the Anilka battles, you mm-hmm. know, when all of a sudden our heroes didn't matter anymore. And it was very difficult for people to come to terms with that.
Yeah. So, Steve, there's this practice, I think, in our history to set up certain individuals as being the history. And then it's the job of historians to go back and find everybody else. So I think kind of the images we have on the parking garage downtown where it's just like the four white guys who yeah. are supposedly represent our history. It's sort of a mainstream political history, but
yeah.
but there's so much more to it, right?
Well, there's all the social history and cultural history, but it's a combination of things. There's a kernel of truth in myth. There's mm-hmm. a kernel of truth in myth.
Right.
Almost always. And let me give you quickly an example, and I want to be the first to tell everybody listening of the new myth.
Okay.
The brand new myth. That Anchorage is the most diverse city in America, that the three high schools, East, Bartlett, and West, are the three most diverse high schools. Well, I talked to Neil Fried the other day from the Department of Labor, does the statistics, and he says, it's not true. Wait a minute, what about Professor Chad Farrell at UAA who came up with the data? Well, it depends on the formula.
Right.
Okay.
The mathematical question.
The mathematical bit, exactly. And Neil came up with this list of several California schools that are more diverse. Well, what is diversity? What's the real point here? The real point isn't to be first, but we all want to be first. And so we're going to embrace that myth, and we have the three most diverse high schools in America. Well, maybe we do and maybe we don't, but that's really beside the point. What's the whole point? The point is that we're a very diverse community. We try to welcome ethnic groups and make them feel welcome, and everybody continue as in the frontier tradition of sharing.
And that's a great myth to have.
And that's a great myth.
May not be true totally all the time, but it's a good one.
Then that's one of the roles of myth, is something to aspire to.
Yeah, yeah. So we've got lots more calls and questions. One for you, Katie. Very quickly, a listener wants to know if you'll have a book signing, and if so, will you do it at the Aviation Museum?
Well, I would be more than happy to do
all right.
that. So, yeah, I love the Aviation Museum. They do a great job down there. And the C-2B that Mudhole got his name in is on display down there. It's a beautiful airplane. And
awesome.
That plane itself has a great story that, you know, you'll have to have one of the curators down there come in and talk about.
Yeah, all right. Aviation Museum, call Katie. Sounds like she'd be willing to do it. Jake is calling from Wasilla. Jake, go ahead.
Hello, Miss Katie. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you.
Yeah, right on. Good to hear. I was curious, with your new book coming out, does it mention Bristol Bay Borough High School and the fact that we had to fly to high school every day from 6th grade to 12th?
Oh, yeah, the bus route. You know, it doesn't. Actually, the publisher made me change my title to Alaska because anything in Alaska sells. It's actually very geographically focused on the Wrangell Mountain area. However, okay. I grew up in Bristol Bay. My father worked for the Alaska Packers Association, so I spent a lot of time at South Naknek. And I know Carville. He used to fly those kids every day over the river to school. And that in Bristol Bay, they have their own aviation history, which is extraordinary. And
I never knew about this.
Yeah.
So did you ride the airplane to school, Jake?
Yes, sir. Every day from 6th grade through 12th.
That's
no man. I love the international airport at South Naknek. It's a shack.
That's great. Thanks for sharing that, Jake. I really enjoy that story.
Very nice.
We're going to run through some calls quickly here.
I'm looking forward to reading your book, Miss Katie. I'm currently on Amazon now trying to give me a copy.
Well, thank you.
Alaska's Sky Boys and by Ringsmith, and we've also got it linked at alaskapublic.org. So we're going to run through some calls here, all coming in at the end. Scott, you had a comment or question about Russian Jack?
Oh, yeah. My question was, if the true Russian Jack was the Grand Marshal of a rendezvous parade, and was that an elected thing?
That's a good story.
Advertisement.
Yeah, that's a good story. He ran for the position. He was put up for the position, but he wasn't elected. He did not actually serve as the Grand Marshal. Bruce and Walter pulled that up. He was on the ballot, and it is an elective position, but he didn't win.
Oh, too bad. That's kind
and
of like...
I have another question, though. Yeah.
Go ahead.
This is focused in the neighborhood in Fairview, but we have a little fur road called Tyonic Drive, but it's not part of the alphabetized grid.
Don't know.
Don't know that one. Have to look it up.
I was really curious about that because they're like right across the street from me.
Okay.
But, yeah. I don't know. That's some of these questions may be lost to history, but in any event, in the room, everyone's shaking our heads. We don't know. And so thanks, Scott. Let's go move on to Ken. Did you have it says your dad was mayor. So I'm curious as to what your call is about.
Yeah, my father was mayor, and he was one of those entrepreneurs who came to Alaska. He just wanted to do things.
And what was his name?
Ken Hinchey.
Oh, Ken Hinchey, of course.
Yeah, he just wanted to do things, and this was the environment for him. He came north and got to start all sorts of businesses and have all sorts of adventures and lived, an exciting life. He was kind of, the nickname was the Imaginary, you know.
I remember
imagine
him.
Something, and then he go and build it. the causeway was one of his special things that he wanted to do, which is what we're talking about, is doing a bridge. But, he spent $50,000 back in the 60s to do the seismic work to see if he could build a causeway across from where the bridge is now proposed. And a coal mine, and had concrete companies and trucking companies, tugs and barges, and just loved doing things like that.
Yeah, when Anchorage is a smaller town,
whether it made money or not. But
yeah, well, I bet he cared, but he didn't necessarily always manage it, right? Exactly. Anchorage was a small town, and you could low barriers to entry. People could start businesses and try things.
Absolutely. Yeah. Came up in 1937 and immediately started a transfer company and a restaurant, and hauled ice in the winter from Spinard. Stored it, and that was the ice they used at all the bars and
how about that
thing back in the day when they didn't have the refrigeration.
Well, thanks. That's a good story. I appreciate your calling.
You bet. Thanks.
We had a lot of mayors before the unification. I think the mayor was like a 1-year term, so there were many mayors of Anchorage. And now, we have a 3-year term. They last a little bit longer.
Right.
Yeah. Let's go to Mary Ellen, also calling from Anchorage. Mary Ellen?
Yes. I was wondering what the explanation is of why we do not have a J Street. I have heard several. One was that because of Swedes, they didn't want a Yay Street. And also why Washington, D.C. also doesn't have a J Street. What do you know about that?
Oh, well, we can do a little myth-breaking on that. That's the United States Postal Service. They can't distinguish. Postmen have too much post. People have too much difficulty distinguishing between J and I.
Oh.
That's a simple explanation.
It is,
and
indeed.
And it's the one. And I mean, it's the real one.
Oh.
Well, that's a good question. Thanks, Mary Ellen. I never knew that. I'm glad to know that. Postal Service is also really responsible for the name of Anchorage because it was essentially on the chart, it said Kinnick Anchorage. People started calling it various names. There was an election. Anchorage, the name Anchorage, did not win the election. But post office is already using Anchorage. So they said too much trouble to change it. So that's where they kept it.
I like it.
It's apparently true.
Mm-hmm. Oh, apparently true, yeah. As far as I know, apparently true.
Yeah, well, good old Postal Service bureaucracy, right? So we've got just a couple of minutes left, but Steve, I know you had done some research on one of our most important early African-American residents, and I wanted you to be able to share that about Zula Swanson.
Ebony Magazine in 1969, November 69, published a feature on Zula Swanson. Zula Swanson had come to Anchorage in 1929, you know, a great year to go anywhere. And she started a rooming house, it was called. Well, the rooming house was, in fact, a cover for a brothel. And she was very successful. She made enough money to purchase a number of properties. She had property on 4th Avenue between I and K Streets. On one side of that today is the Captain Cook Hotel. On the other side is, of all things, the State Court Building.
All right.
And she was a favorite at posting bond for people who were getting in trouble because the underworld circulated through her world. But she was a very respectable woman, in fact, and she did, in fact, own property. She built a wonderful home out overlooking Goose Lake on East Northern Lights Boulevard when it was still a dirt path. And Ebony pointed out that when they interviewed her in 1969, she had just purchased a Cadillac Fleetwood so that nobody else would have to drive her to the store. There was a wonderful testimonial dinner for her in Anchorage in 1971. She was a highly respected citizen. And the title of the Ebony article was Richest Black in Alaska.
Yeah. She seems to have been a really well-regarded person. And I saw her her obituary, which was funny because it said that she, in the early days, she was owner of one of the most popular businesses in town,
right?
But doesn't say what kind of business it was.
Well, one of the mythologies, perhaps, that we have to look behind is that in Western towns, and this was sort of a Western town, in the early 20th century, prostitution was right out in the open.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knew it happened, and they didn't try to cover it up the way it was covered up later.
Yeah. So, Katie, we're running out of time, but I wanted to get to another topic with you, which is that these early cowboy aviators, these guys who are in this really scrappy industry, they created some really big companies.
Yeah.
You know, we think about Alaska Airlines, seventh biggest airline in the country.
True.
Revolution Airways was a big company in its time. Mm-hmm. How did that evolution take place? I mean, from one to the other, it seems like two totally opposite ends.
Well, in the early
spectrum.
Days, they were all, you know, they all called themselves after themselves, right? Reeve, you know, and you know, so they, you know, Gillam Airways, Reeve Airways, all, and then it, because they were carrying around stuff, and it wasn't until after the war when new technologies came along that they became airlines.
Yeah.
So Cordova Airlines, Mudhole Smith converts, but they're all merging together, which was also kind of the corporate way to do things. And Reeve is actually the only independent that continued all the way through up until 2000. Yeah, so everybody else merged together, moved their routes.
Consolidation,
and their, yeah, because it was about making profits and safety and regulations. So
yeah.
But I did want to say that your listeners are the caretakers of this history and that they should get involved and continue to tell these stories, talk to their historical societies or local museums, because what they do is really important.
Right. You're here.
And we have to go, but thanks to both of my guests, Katie Ringsmuth, author of Alaska's Sky Boys, which you can find locally or on Amazon, Steve Haycox, professor, author of Alaska American Colony. I'm Charles Wolforth. Our producer today was Dave Waldron. That's all for Hometown Alaska. Thanks for listening.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.